I wonder, do you ever pause for very long and think about the meaning of life, the purpose of our existence here on earth? It's a subject which, if we're honest with ourselves, can be quite daunting and even depressing when we look at the world in which we live. And we look at the things that go on it, and we look at our small part of the world, our small place in it, for the brief amount of time that we're here, and we ask the question, why? Why am I here? What's the significance of me being here at this time in history, for as many years as the Lord God may give to me? What's it all about? Why am I here? Have you ever asked those questions? Have you ever paused to think through the possible answers that one might come up with? And do you ever feel, after considering these things, that, well, actually, life is pretty meaningless? It's pretty futile. It's pretty empty. Or, as the preacher in Ecclesiastes says, it's vanity. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Spain, it's empty. It's an absurdity. It's a frustration. It's a futility. It's nonsense. It's meaningless. Do you ever feel that way? I do. You look at your life and you think, well, what is it all about? Well, the writer of Ecclesiastes deals with this question and comes to a conclusion at the end about where we can find meaning in life. The book is split into three sections. There's the first section, which we read together this morning, chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. It's a sort of an introduction. It sets the stage for the remainder of the book. It introduces the topic, the meaning of life. And it gives us a taste for what is to come. That life is vanity. It's meaningless. And these opening verses, these first 11 verses, are given to us by a narrator. He's introducing the words of the preacher, which will come next. He says there, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. This is what the preacher says: vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And then the narrator continues from verse 3 to verse 11 to introduce the basic theme that the preacher is going to follow for a fairly lengthy discourse, which takes up the second part of the book, from Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 12, right the way through to Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 7. That is one long quotation of what the preacher had to say. Now, who is this preacher? Well, the immediate reaction to the way that it's worded in the introduction is that, well, he must be Solomon. And from bits of information that we glean as we go through the book of Ecclesiastes, many have concluded, well, this must be Solomon. The words of the preacher, or the teacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. He's a king, he's a son of David, and he's a teacher, he's a preacher. Or as we will see later on, he's a wise man. And of course we think of Solomon as being the wisest man that ever lived. And yet there are others who question whether the preacher really is Solomon himself. Is the narrator quoting the actual words of Solomon? Or is he perhaps writing words that Solomon might have written? Is he putting himself in Solomon's shoes and writing as though he was Solomon? Or is he quoting someone else who has done that, stood in Solomon's shoes and written these words? Well, there's certainly no certainty about the answer to that question. Some will argue very strongly that it was Solomon. Others will argue equally strongly that it was not Solomon, but someone sort of ghost writing for Solomon, if you like, putting themselves in Solomon's shoes, using the kind of language that Solomon may have used. There's good arguments for each position, and personally I'm undecided, and really it doesn't actually matter whether it was literally Solomon who took a quill, if they used quills in those days, I'm not quite sure what they wrote with then, a piece of stick on parchment, dipping it in his ink and writing away. Was it Solomon there in his palace in Jerusalem? Or was it someone maybe 200 or 300 or 400 years later on, having seen the results of some of the things that Solomon did, writing with some hindsight? Well, we'll pick up on some more of those thoughts as we go through this book. Really, it doesn't matter whether it was literally Solomon or someone ghostwriting in Solomon's place. But the second section is basically a long quotation from a wise man who's trying to get to grips with what he sees in the world, trying to establish what is the meaning of life. And then in the last few verses there, from verse 8 of chapter 12 to the end of the book, just those concluded 5-6 verses, we return to the narrator, who basically puts his own conclusion at the end of this book. He's introduced it, he's given this long quotation from the preacher or the teacher, and then he gives his closing remarks. He sums up like a lawyer in a court. After all the evidence has been heard, he stands before the jury and he gives his summation. And he brings his conclusion and he makes his exhortation. This is the decision you, the jury, should make, having heard the evidence. So this is the narrator's task then. He's introducing the theme. He's allowing someone else to speak on that theme. And then he brings his closing remarks, taking conclusions from what has been spoken. So let's look at this introduction this morning. Let's consider the verses that we have before us here. And this morning I just want to work our way through these 11 verses and draw out some thoughts and point in the direction of the conclusion that we ought to come to as people living here at the beginning of the 21st century. So we've considered then the words of the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Life is meaningless, is what the preacher is saying. That's how the narrator sums it up at the beginning. And this is the argument then. He begins by saying, well, what profit has a man from all his labour in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. What's the point of life? What profit do we get out of life? What do we achieve from living on this earth for our 70 years or whatever length of time the Lord may give us? What's it all about? He says, you know, in the end, we labour all our lives and it ends in death. One generation passes away, another generation comes, that generation passes away, another generation comes, and so on, and so on, and so on. Through the course of history, one generation after another. What's the point? What profit has a man in all the labour that he does? You go off to work. Tomorrow morning, Monday morning, your favourite day of the week, I know. And off to work you go. And you sit in your office. You stand in your lab. You sit at your desk at school. Wherever it is you go, and you do the same thing as you did last Monday, and the Monday before that, and the Monday before that, and the Monday before that, for as long now as you can remember, the same thing over and over and over. Why? What's the point? Your life will come to an end. You'll pass on. Another generation, someone else will take your place. At that desk, in that lab, wherever it may be, doing the same thing that you did Monday after Monday. What's the point? Where's it going? What profit is there in this? Week after week, the same routine. Saturday comes. Oh, what a relief. Don't have to go to work today. Mow the lawns. Weed the garden. Do all those jobs around the house, one Saturday after another Saturday, same routine. And life becomes something of a monotony, doesn't it? You stop and think about it. What is the point? What profit am I getting out of this life that I'm living? Well, is there any point? Meaningless. Vanity. Absurdity, says the preacher. Here we are, and we're here, but for a moment. In the larger scheme of things, we are so insignificant. The earth, it abides forever. In comparison to us, what are our 70, 80, 90 years here? In the bigger scheme of things, what impact do we make? Do we make any at all? Is there any point to us being here? And then the narrator goes on to give three illustrations of the repetitive monotony of life. In verse 5 he says, the sun, it rises, the sun goes down, it hastens to the place from where it arose. It is not a scientific statement. He's using the kind of language that we use every day. Oh, what a beautiful sunrise. What a gorgeous sunset. The sun rises, the sun sets, it goes back to where it began. It rises, it sets, back to where it began. Rises, sets, rises, sets, rises, sets. Every day the same. On and on and on and on it goes. It's been doing this for thousands of years. Every day the same. Just like Monday mornings. A drudgery. A meaningless repetition. No end to it. No conclusion. No aim. No purpose. No destination. Just round and round and round it goes. Just like life. Then he goes on and he says, the wind. Well, think about the wind. The wind goes down towards the south. Then it turns and then it's a north wind. And then it's an east and a west. And round it goes on its circuit. We don't know where it comes from. We don't know where it's going. But it feels that way, doesn't it? One thing after another. Just round and round. Just following some kind of invisible course. Always blowing, but never getting anywhere. Always moving, but never reaching a destination. Meaningless, vanity, absurdity. Well, here's one. How about the rivers? Well, the rivers, they run into the sea. But the sea doesn't get full. It all goes back to the place from which it came. there they return again. And so there's this great cycle that's going on. Rain, streams, rivers, ocean, evaporation, clouds, rain, streams, rivers, ocean, evaporation, clouds, rain. And on and on and on it goes. I mean, fill something up. Come on. But no. No, it's just this futile circuit. Round and round, getting nowhere, reaching no destination, apparently having no purpose whatsoever. No conclusion ever reached. And so these things have continued since the beginning of time. The sun rising, the sun setting, the sun rising, the sun setting. The wind coming, the wind going, it's come again and it goes again. The rain falling, flowing into the sea, up into the clouds, back down as rain, on and on since the beginning of time. Meaningless, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. And this is our life. Just a continual cycle of birth. Living a vain, worthless, empty, meaningless life, death. Someone else is born, lives an empty, meaningless, worthless life, dies. Someone else is born. And so the cycle goes on and on and on. This is what he's saying. What a meaningless, worthless, empty, vain life we live. What on earth are we doing here? And he goes on and he says, all things are wearisome. They're full of labour. It's, you know, we can't express the futility of it all. The weariness of it all. You know, we want something new. We want something to reach its conclusion at last. But he says, you know, with all the seeing that you do throughout your life, you're never satisfied. You want to see more. Your eyes are never filled. They never come to the point where they say, I've seen enough, I can close them now, and I'm not going to see another thing. Your ears continually hearing sounds all day, all night, even in your sleep, continually hearing the sounds around you. They never stop hearing the sounds around you from the beginning of your life to the end of your life. They never are satisfied. There never comes a point when your ears say, I've heard enough. Well, sometimes you feel like that, but it wouldn't last for long. And so he comes to this point that he says, that which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Aha, hang on, preacher, you got it wrong. You got it wrong there. Don't you remember when the wheel was invented? Wasn't there a wheel before that? There was something new. Of course, we live in an age where everything's new all the time, isn't it? Adverts bombard us with the latest, the newest, the most recent. We're captivated with things that are new. But that's not what the preacher's saying. They may have had a slower pace of life back then. You know, they didn't have a new computer coming out every 2 weeks. But they still had new things to look forward to. You know, add a bit of spice to life. I'm sure. Not as much as we have. But there were still new things. No, that's not what the preacher's saying. He's not saying that no one would ever come up with the idea of a motor car to replace the coach, horse and coach. He's not saying that there's no new thing in that sense. What he's saying is there's nothing that brings an end to this endless cycle, to this endless routine, to this endless monotony. Nothing comes along which changes the whole course of life and makes it completely different. And instead of the sun rising and setting, it stays there. Wow, that would be new. Instead of the wind always whisking around and going on its circuit, completely still. Not a breath of wind for eternity. He's saying, look, there's nothing comes along which makes life really significantly different. Someone invents a wheel. Well, it makes life a bit easier, but people still live. They still do all those mundane jobs. They still die. Someone else takes their place, is born, live, die, born, live, die, born, live, die. The wheel hasn't changed that. The computer hasn't changed that. All the new things that we have bombarding us on the adverts day after day, none of them will ever change that. The significant things, the real things, life goes on just as it was before. Spiced up a bit maybe, but it's still the same life. Still the empty life, the vain life, the meaningless life. There's nothing new under the sun, says the preacher. It's all been there. It's the same thing repeated over and over again. And there's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. He's returning here to where he started off. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away, another generation comes. There is no remembrance of the former things, former generations. Nor will there be any remembrance of the generations that are to come by those who will come after them. I may put that language in there. We remember some people in the past, certainly. You know, we remember the great people who have had an impact on history. Adam and Eve, Abraham, David, Solomon. We remember some of the figures in history that have had a huge impact upon the world. Those who have done great good and those who have done great evil, like Hitler and Stalin. They'll be etched in our memories for generations to come, certainly. But even there, some of those are fading. The Hannibals, once great, illustrious people. How many of you have heard of Hannibal? Well, a few of you. But where's his memory now? But more significantly, it's not just the few out of the millions, the billions who have lived, the few that we can recall through the history of time. What about the people like you and me? Where are they? You know, the ordinary people, not the people who made great inventions, had huge advances in medical science, were great military leaders. Great thoughts of philosophy. Where's the ordinary people? You know, the people who went out on a Monday morning, taught in class, went to work in the field, milked the cows, went home at the end of the day, weary and worn, and got up the next day and did the same thing, and week after week, and month after month, and year after year through their lives. What about them? There is no remembrance of former things. These people, what was the point in their lives? We don't remember them. What impact did they have on the world? Did they have any? Well, apparently not. It's all forgotten. It's all in the past. Will people remember us? People remember you? But your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, maybe, possibly. I mean, how far do you remember back? I remember my great-grandmother on my mother's side. My great-grandmother on my father's side was alive, but I don't remember her. I know about my family back another two generations. Beyond that, I haven't got a clue. Someone once did a family tree for my mother's side of the family and decided that one of our ancestors was the man in the crow's nest who saw America first. Yeah, right. Okay, so there's a claim to fame. But you see what he's saying here. It's all just an endless cycle that seems to go on forever and have no ultimate goal. There's no purpose. There's no meaning. There's no destination. There's no end in sight. It's just the same thing over and over and over and over again. Now let me home in on a phrase that appears here and gets repeated throughout this book. What profit has a man from all his labour in which he toils under the sun? That phrase is the key to understanding the book of Ecclesiastes. If you don't understand this phrase and how it fits in, Ecclesiastes is a confusion. It itself is meaningless. So here's the key that unlocks the door to the meaning of Ecclesiastes. Under the sun. Here is a wise man, and he is a wise man. He's a philosopher of his day. He's recognized, if you like, as being a great teacher, a preacher, a wise man. And he is saying that everything is meaningless under the sun. What he's saying there is this life, this world, on this earth, apart from God, under the sun, without consideration of God and eternity. Now, God will come into this, but not in the sense of being someone to hope in, someone to look forward to being with, but in the sense of being a deity that sort of oversees what's going on in this world and actually adds to the meaninglessness and frustration of life, rather than giving an answer to it. It's under the sun. When we look at it from an earthly, worldly perspective, life is meaningless. And to bring it into a New Testament context, because this is the age in which we live, life outside of Christ is meaningless. Life apart from the teachings which Jesus brought, and the life that Jesus lived, and the death that Jesus died, is meaningless. It's worthless. It's empty. It's an absurdity. It's a frustration. It's a wearisome thing. And as we'll see later on, we may as well eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. We may as well get the most out of life that we can now, because at the end of it, well, that's it. Leave it all to someone else. No, we come to this book and we understand this book, recognizing that the preacher is talking from a worldly perspective, from a perspective apart from God, distant from God, at odds with God, rather than one who is allied to God, understands God and his purposes, and has hope for the future. Meaning and purpose isn't found in this world, in this life, isn't found by living. That's not where we find meaning and purpose. It's not by the things that we do, as good as those things may be. Meaning and purpose in life is not found in those things. Meaning and purpose in life is found in God. Our purpose is to please God. Our purpose is to serve God, to acknowledge God's existence, and to live our lives for God, with Him as our goal. And we need to come at our lives from an eternal perspective, not from an earthbound perspective, which is given to us here in the book of Ecclesiastes. We need to recognize God's place in this world. Furthermore, and fundamentally, as people living in the 21st century, we need to recognize Jesus Christ's place in history and in our lives. Because apart from him, there is no meaning. It is all futile, meaningless, vain, just an endless series of meaningless nothings. But when we have Christ, and when we understand Christ's person and his work, then it brings meaning, because in Jesus Christ we're able to glorify and serve God. Outside of Jesus Christ we can never do that. So as we work through then this book of Ecclesiastes over the next 5 weeks, we'll be seeing the frustrating time the preacher has in trying to come to terms with the world he lives in from a worldly perspective. And each time we consider a portion, we'll look and see, well, how does it fit into today's world? And how can we find meaning and purpose when we look from an eternal perspective instead of from an earthbound perspective? And let us pray that the Lord will help us and bless us as we work our way through this book.